We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au. I was just asking people while we were waiting to start to write down a question on the theme of religious, spiritual, ethical or moral. Something to ponder. So I hope you can write that down straight away and we'll collect those shortly. Of course, we meet on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people. We respect their elders, past and present. First of all, sadly, I inform you of the death of Marjorie Wellburn, who died peacefully in June at the age of 102. A service to celebrate her life will be held here at the Unitarian Meeting House on Friday the 21st of July, that's next Friday, at 1 p.m. And there will be a live stream recording. Somewhere in the notices, and I think most people have them emailed, you can find the address for the live streaming or recording. And if you can't find that, then please contact Mary in the office and she can give you the details. On Wednesday this week, Words of Spirit, where we reflect on scripture and holy words of various kinds. That's 6 p.m. here at the Meeting House for an hour. It's always a beautiful gathering. Everyone's welcome. In terms of special events coming up, I should mention that on Wednesday, the 26th of July, we are hosting an interfaith forum and dinner. That's a program that's been going on for quite some time now with a group of people of various faiths from around Adelaide. And for the first time, the Unitarian Meeting House will be hosting that dinner. And of course, everyone here is welcome. Once again, I'd advise you to find the details in the notices to reply to Denise, who's taking the replies. Of course, you will need to advise if you are coming for catering purposes, and there is a small cost for those attending. That'll be 5:45 to 6 p.m. on Wednesday, the 26th of July. At the end of this month, we have a visiting Unitarian minister from the US, the Reverend Dr. Laura Kim Joyner. And before the service that she's taking on the 30th of July, she is offering a bird walk on the previous day, the Saturday, the 29th of July at 3 p.m, walking through the Adelaide Botanic Gardens. She is in fact a parrot conservationist. That is one of her fields of expertise. And she will have a lot to say about birds generally, if you're interested in nature, birds, and if you'd like to talk to her in some depth. She'll be available that previous day at 3 p.m. Meanwhile, for anyone connected with our young people, Sunday Club Winter Camp is commencing 2 o'clock this Wednesday, 19th of July, and goes until midday on the Friday. And I think most of you would know David Freesmith, but otherwise, if you do need more details, again, you can speak to Mary in the office. I should mention that as you leave today, you may wish to provide a financial contribution to keep this place running, but the most important contribution is you being here. And now it's time for our prelude music, The Wind on the Hill. And I am interested to know that the words were written by A.A. Milne of Winnie the Pooh fame. So who knew that he wrote songs as well? So thank you, Robin. We're very glad that you're with us today to provide music. Thank you. Come together as a community with more questions than answers, but at least in a community that cares for each other, we are strengthened in our own free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Now I'll ask Helen to come forward with a poem listed here as a ghazal, which means a song actually, by Rumi, the great Persian poet. And while that's happening, Sandy, could you collect people's questions? Thank you.
If you pass your night and merge it with dawn for the sake of heart, what do you think will happen? If the entire world is covered with blossoms you have laboured to plant, what do you think will happen? If the elixir of life that has been hidden in the dark fills the desert and towns, what do you think will happen? If, because of your generosity and love, a few humans find their lives, what do you think will happen? If you pour an entire jar filled with joyous wine on the head of those already drunk, what do you think will happen? Go, my friend. Bestow your love even on your enemies. If you touch their hearts, what do you think will happen?
Now we come to the time of lighting candles of joy and concerns, a traditional part of the service where we can share some personal reflection, something that has touched us. I would like to express some joy at this morning's weather. I do seem to be the only one who finds it pleasantly warm, and the Bureau of Meteorology is telling us it was 6 degrees as I was walking some distance to get here, but it was most pleasant, I must say. Would anyone else like to share? Well, if there are no more, I'll light a final candle for those joys and concerns which we have in our hearts. We all do, but we may not be up to sharing them right now. So a final candle for those joys and concerns. Let's just take a moment to reflect on what we've heard. Let's be thankful for family and the support around us. Whether we've been in the same place for a long time or we're coming into a new environment or new relationships. Please know that there is that love and support around you. Those relationships we can be grateful for. And let us all consider how we can help those around us, giving our love and kindness. Reading from a comment by Charles Bukowski, an American 20th century poet and author. John, I think you're coming forward to read that. Thank you.
For those who believe in God, most of the big questions are answered. But for those of us who don't readily accept the God formula, the big answers don't remain stone written. We adjust to new conditions and discoveries. We are pliable. Love need not be a command, nor faith a dictum. I am my own God. We are here to unlearn the teachings of the church, state, and our educational system. We are here to drink beer. We are here to kill war. We are here to laugh at the odds and live our lives so well that death will tremble to take us.
Thank you very much. And now our interlude, Liebe Strahme from Liszt. Thank you, Robin. Showing a cartoon on the screen which says, I really can't think of a thing to preach about this morning, so I'll entertain questions from the floor.
Well, what I'm going to do, having indeed received some questions from the floor in writing, I've jumbled them up and I'm going to pull them out of my hat, so to speak, and offer some reflections upon them. And I'll step out from behind the lectern, so this is about as vulnerable as someone can get. I'm grateful to Peter for advising me early on that as Unitarians, we're not here to answer your questions, we're here to question your answers. And it's a very fitting introduction to today. Of course, some of these questions will no doubt be far too difficult for me to entertain. So, to use a phrase from the political arena, they'll be taken as questions on notice. So, and indeed, there might be some fertile ground for future reflections on Sunday mornings. So let's start off with this one. How can good people gain political power? Well, it's a question very close to my heart, or at least my history. It is a very good question, and the foundation to it really begins with how one views the world. For the materialist, there is nothing but trying to get power if you want to do good. There is nothing inherently bad about power. Of course, what is critical is the intention. For those who have some sense of transcendence, the answer may take a slightly different path, because the goings-on in this world are relatively insignificant compared to what happens behind the scenes, or one might say above the scenes. Ever since Plato, at least, there's been a distinction between what we see and the real essence of things. And what is important for us in terms of a spiritual search is to explore that possibility that there is a world of essential things, a world of goodness, beauty, and truth, which can be discovered along with this world of material forms. And one could even say, despite this world of material forms, we get sucked into the games, interests, and addictions of this material world. And very often that includes playing the political game. It's not at all clear that that's the way forward to our own enlightenment and, let's say, salvation, however you might understand that term. Having said that, the question implies that people of goodwill want to influence the world, and indeed, just last week we were talking about works of mercy which good people are called upon to undertake, which have corporeal effect. So the Catholic Church, going back 1500 years, recognized that there were spiritual good works and there were corporal good works. Feeding the hungry, visiting the sick, visiting those who were imprisoned. All of these things are worthy and are merciful. The pursuit of political power to make sure that people are fed, that people are housed, that people are given a liberal education. And I mean one which encourages them to think, not just to remember facts and figures. These are worthy pursuits if you want to do your work in the world. As for the specifics of how to become more powerful, to have more influence on those who govern us, it is a very daunting prospect, I can tell you. I mean, in this country, we have a two-party system, effectively. There are profound differences at times, and in some respects also, they're like management team A, management team B. But I'm not going to get into political commentary beyond that. The fact is that to influence that whole process, I suppose there are two ways. One is to join a political party and get involved that way, whatever political party seems to have the greatest affinity with your own personal values. And the other is to be in contact with other people who advocate for particular causes. whether it be housing or freedom for people in Palestine or freedom for other people around the world, for better living conditions for Aboriginal people, and just housing and healthcare in Australia generally. There are different groups with whom you can connect and therefore be more powerful in what we have as essentially a democracy. These are the ways forward. Getting together with other people who have similar values and goals is probably the path to political power, if I can put it in the most general sense. And let us be very thankful that we do more or less live in a democracy. There are threats to it. There are those who would do away with it and diminish it. But essentially, we do live in a democracy where we can have a say and, at least at the margins, have some influence. So let's be thankful for that, something which so many people in the world aren't able to enjoy. I turn to the next question. What can be done to most lift our spirits? Well, that's a very good question. I have always found that the foundation to this question is having a clear framework for life. Because once you have a sense of mission to serve others, whether it be the broader community, just the people around you, your neighbours, whatever that might mean, even just your family, even your pets. If you have a commitment to serve others and you have an understanding of the world, that's a good start. And then when you actually take steps to help people, it is so gratifying. So that is one of the things I would say is most uplifting. And then we can be thankful for the company we keep. It's most important to keep our company with people who have similar values, not just that, but people who are encouraging, people who are inspirational, people who are decent. And we can be very thankful that in this group, as Unitarians, we do have that company. We have the facility to listen to an amazing variety of uplifting music and to observe uplifting art. One of the great blessings of living in this time and place is that there is so much available to us. Sometimes the difficulty is choosing what to hear and what to see. But as we stand, we have the great music of many, many centuries. Music which celebrates perhaps a conception of God, but we can interpret that in our own way and find it uplifting to the soul. The next question is religion needed? Well, this is another question that needs to be unpacked, because one immediately distinguishes between spirituality and religion. Now, my friend Aristotle would say, actually, you don't even need spirituality. You just get on with the practical things of life. Science is your best guide to how to live rationally. And indeed, it's rational to behave decently in society, otherwise you'll get into trouble and you won't have a good life. So that certainly is a simple black and white form of answer to that. The challenge of distinguishing between spirituality and religion, now that does start to become more complicated. We see in all of the world's great religions, I think I can say all of them, that they begin with a great prophet, somebody who has a sense of communion with God or the gods. There are philosophies also, and I would include Buddhism among that, which also rely on a great teacher. So I'm using prophet, teacher very loosely. Holy people who had a great insight into the human condition and how we might overcome what these days we would call our ego, to be at one with our soul and, for those who have that concept, to be one with our God. But then, of course, what happens to those of us as lesser beings who don't have that same great insight, same great sense of communion with God or with humanity? We have to read about it from someone else. We receive book knowledge, and if we want to then meet as a group and talk about it and adopt the identity of a group that follows that teaching, we set up a religion. And there'll be rules, there'll be dogma, and so forth. Incidentally, one of the remarkable things really about this group of Unitarians is that we somehow stick together without that agreed dogma. I mean, it's astonishing, really, to have lasted 150 years just in South Australia without always having agreed dogma. And of course, as religion goes on, there are people with more or less spiritual insight who adhere to the religion. And it's not a bad thing for those people without a sense of inspiration, without a sense of the divine, to adhere to a religion and receive from it moral instruction. Every religion or beneficial philosophy has a sense of instructing people ethically into ethical living. And this is not a bad thing, because not everyone is a philosopher. Not everyone wants to do the reading, the thinking, the conversing to get to that point of wisdom. You have to start somewhere. So it makes sense to start with a book that gives ethical instruction. So whether that be the Bible or any of the other great religious works, it's a starting point. But as you go on, you realise that there is the form of the religion, there are the scriptures, but then there is the essence behind it. And the essence always leads to either that sense of compassion for all humanity or a sense of communion with God, however that might be conceived or experienced. So is religion necessary? Let's just say that religion is. Full stop. Now the next question is how to be inclusive yet not wishy-washy. And fortunately, having some experience of government, the term is not unfamiliar to me. I'm extremely familiar with the term wishy-washy. Oh, and also inclusive, yes. I suppose it comes back to the question of tolerance, doesn't it? Because we are a tolerant group, and as we say every Sunday, everyone is welcome here. People of any ethnicity, sexual background or orientation, any gender, and so on and so forth. And that is sincere, absolutely sincere. But I suppose what we're saying is that we welcome people no matter what their background, but their attitudes might be a different matter. I'm not sure how well we tolerate the intolerant. So we are indeed inclusive, but there is a line to be drawn somewhere. If somebody came in the door and said, look, I'm a homicidal Nazi whatever, it would be worth having a conversation. But The problem with intolerant people is that they can be closed to love, closed even to rational debate. Because the very nature of intolerance is that it says that kind of person is beyond the pale, is unacceptable. And usually it's not about a particular person, it's about a whole class of people, an ethnicity or a political class or maybe people of a certain age or something. So when we're faced with that intolerance, we can't necessarily shift that attitude. We can really only do that by loving conversation, an attempt to show that person that, in fact, we are all human beings worthy of respect and dignity. But that conversation can only go so far. If there's not common ground on that point, it is difficult to go beyond. So, by all means, let's be inclusive. And what we mean by that, it doesn't matter what your background, your religious heritage, your ethnic heritage, etc. We are inclusive very genuinely in that regard. But we're not wishy-washy in the sense that we will tolerate bad behaviour or destructive attitudes. I'll go to another question. I'm not putting up with any more of that. And look, this is a very similar question. Is it possible in every instance to find the inherent worth in all people? So, I suppose the challenge is when we come across intolerant people, not to be judgmental. Is that a contradiction? Well, what I mean is we have to be careful not to engage our own ego in the process. And it's difficult because intolerant people usually have a knack, because their ego is operating on the basis that I am right and the other people are wrong. There's automatically a barrier there, but they often have a knack to pinprick your own ego and to provoke anger, resentment, judgment in you. Now that is something about which you have control, and you are invited to retain your self-composure, not to react to pricks from... let me finish the sentence. Not to react to pricks from other people's egos as they provoke you. You are invited to retain that self-composure, lack of judgment, but about the person, because you can still love that person, but condemn their behaviour, their racism, their sexism, their bigotry of whatever kind. Let's go to another question before I get into any more trouble. Here we are. How to solve major conflicts between morality and religion? And there are a couple of examples given, but I'll just keep it at a general level. Earlier on, I was saying that there's often a wonderful, glorious spiritual impulse at the heart of the world's religions and philosophies. But as a structure is built around that, a church in the sense of buildings rather than people and wisdom and love, rules are written, books are prescribed, and some of those rules, of course, have a special meaning at a particular time. So what might have been a good rule for very sound practical reasons 2,500 years ago or 2,000 years ago may not necessarily be essential given our state of medicine, our state of scientific knowledge and so forth today. So maybe I'm making this too general. But the point is that rules are written down for a particular people at a particular time. If one keeps to a morality based on respect for all human beings, freedom, free of judgment, a sense of justice for all human beings, a sense of compassion for all human beings, then that can guide our behaviour, the principles rather than the rules. This is the Unitarian position, in essence. So in terms of conflict between religion and morality, how does it come up? It comes up sometimes when we want to behave in a particular way, and yet the criminal law or the religion, the dominant religion of the day, might forbid it. It's less of a problem these days because we honestly live in such a pluralistic society with extraordinary level of liberal freedom, again, compared to most periods in history in most parts of the world. But sometimes we do come up against this difficult problem. And I'm not sure that one can prescribe a rule to overcome the problem. It's a matter of dealing very sensitively with these issues as they come up, whether it be abortion or euthanasia or something like this. It's a matter of very sensitively dealing with the human being in front of us. Here's another question. Do all religions see human suffering as punishment from a god or gods? Well, it's certainly not a universal view. I was talking here about sin just last week, the concept of sin and to a degree how that came about in the Christian context, which of course came out of the Jewish context a couple of thousand years ago. The idea of a judgment day is really at the foundation of it, and that goes back to the Chaldean religions of what is now Persia, Iran, that sort of area. The idea that at the end of the day, human beings will be sifted into good and bad, and therefore there'll be punishment for the bad and rewards for the good. I mean, you can see the wonderful psychological imperative that it provides. It was clearly beneficial in terms of encouraging good behaviour, but as we all here know, with the life experience and knowledge about psychology that we have, that to impose a sense of guilt on a person for a misdeed is not necessarily the best way of improving behaviour and returning people to a view of humanity which is compassionate. It's not really the case, though, that all religions see punishment from God, the consequence of bad behaviour. As I was saying last week, in the Hindu and Buddhist traditions, a very different answer was developed. They do acknowledge sin in the sense of people can do the wrong thing. If you are not compassionate toward another, if you refuse food to a hungry person, you're not doing the right thing, generally speaking. But it's not as if God's then going to strike you down with a lightning bolt, or even at the end of time, condemn you to some place of torture. The fact is that there's a law of karma which operates like a law of physics. If you do wrong, then wrong will be done to you. And it doesn't even require a supernatural agency. It's just what happens in life on earth. This is, you could say, popularly accepted in the phrase, what you put out is what you get back. You probably have heard that said. And indeed, there are other understandings of suffering as well. The concept that by being in this material world, that suffering is inevitable. So the Buddhist tradition is that it's inevitable that there is suffering, and the cause of it is attachment to things in the world. And so that we rise above that, not with any sense of not caring about other people or what's happening, but in the sense of being free. Someone asked me a few weeks ago, what is freedom? And I said, freedom is being conscious of one's passions and then being able to, with wisdom and love, decide how to act. So, suffering. It is something that we can understand and overcome without resort to the concept of God. But for those who have that concept that there is a God, generally speaking, there will be a God that is beneficial and who wants us to rise above suffering. And the major religions will give a pathway for a person to be able to achieve that. The next question is probably a little bit more functional about this place. Here is a question: is God nature? Well, certainly, I would approach it a different way. There is, to the extent that you can entertain a concept of God, I would say you can find God through communion with nature, through experiencing fully the healthy green atmosphere of a walk in the bush, even a walk around Mount Lofty or a walk around Shady Grove. I think the essence to that experience is being able to experience what's around us without ego reaction, without being caught up in conflict with other people or worrying about getting a parking ticket or worrying about the shopping or anything like that. If we can fully experience nature, it comes close or comparable, one might say, to experiencing God. Arguably, that same experience could be found anywhere, but it's facilitated in completely natural surroundings, and I mean comfortable natural surroundings, walking through the bush, sitting on the beach, gazing at the ocean, because of that fact that it gives us nothing to worry about, nothing but taking in the environment. That experience of being in the moment is certainly a key, I think, to the pathway to self-realization, wisdom, and love. Let's just take one more question before I go on too long. Why do some religions see they are dividing the community by judgment and unwelcome to progressive thinking? I've paraphrased slightly. Well, I suppose the key answer there is that others do what others do. Sadly, we can't change the fact that everybody in the world, really to a greater or lesser extent, has their prejudices, has their blockages to full self-realization. There are very few of us, maybe none of us, at the level of Yeshua or the Buddha or these other wonderful teachers. So when we find that other religions are perhaps disturbing people, even blocking people from self-realization in some way or another, there's not much we can do but be available to hear people and heal people if we come across people who are being hurt in that way. We welcome them. We give them our full attention and whatever kind help and advice we can give. But again, One doesn't want to get caught up in the ego trap of judging other religions. They do what they do, we do what we do. One would hope that eventually everyone's on the same path, and we all have obstacles to overcome. It is perhaps particularly sad that some of those problems might be caused by religious experience. I'd like to finish with a little story, and I don't claim credit for this one. This one is from Leo Tolstoy. It's the story of a king, could be a queen, but thanks to Leo, I'll say it's a king. And I'm going to paraphrase the story for you. So the king, having conquered his territories, sat in his palace and turned his mind to some of the philosophical questions of life. And he asked his people at court, the lawyers, the doctors, the philosophers, the preachers, the priests, he asked them three questions. And he said, I would like to know, when is the most auspicious time to start a project? And secondly, who are the people that I should be listening to? And thirdly, what is the most important thing I should be doing? Good questions. Well, of course, all of the lawyers, priests, and doctors all had different answers. They all wanted the king to listen to them, of course. But there was such a confusion, the king thought, no, I'm going to have to go beyond all of this. And the king had heard of a hermit that lived way out in the forest at the edge of the kingdom. The problem was, it was said that the hermit only listened to common people and advised the common people, not lawyers and doctors and kings. So the king decided to disguise himself as an ordinary peasant farmer. And notwithstanding that he left his palace with a substantial retinue of soldiers and so on, as usual, when he got near the hermit's forest, he went on alone. And sure enough, he came across the hermit who was in the little vegetable patch outside a humble hut, digging away and putting in some seedlings. And the king, in disguise, asked the hermit these three questions. And the hermit looked up unhelpfully and just kept digging. The king thought, what am I going to do? I know, I've got to perhaps curry favour in some way. So he picked up a little spade and started digging the next row alongside the hermit. And he thought, well, you know, the hermit's seen that I've got some credibility now. I'll ask the questions again, which he did. And just then, someone stumbled out from the forest next to the vegetable patch. Someone with a terrible wound in his stomach. He'd been cut. And the king, essentially being a compassionate person, went over and saw the wound and immediately started tending to it and helping the person, carried him inside and started applying bandages. The wound was so bad that the man couldn't be moved. No conversation took place about how the wound got there. All the focus was on just helping the person. And they stayed the night there, the three of them. In the morning, the king went to see how the wounded man was, and the wounded person said, look, I have a confession to make. I recognized, as you were coming to the forest, that you were the king. And the royal soldiers had destroyed my brother's farm and killed him. And I was coming to kill you. But as I came through the forest, one of your soldiers was able to stab me to protect you, but I ran and fell down at the vegetable patch. But I've seen how decent you really are, and I'm not going to kill you. All I ask is to be able to walk away from here, and that'll be the end of it. And the king inquired about his name, gave him a little note that granted him safe passage, and said that his brother's farm would be restored. After the man slowly and gently made his way out, the king thought, well, this is my last chance to ask the hermit the three questions. So he said, what is the best time to initiate a project? Who should I be listening to? And what is the most important thing I could be doing? And the hermit said, you have just answered your own questions. The time to start any project is now. The people you should be listening to are the people you are with. And the most important thing you can do is to help the people you are with.
We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.